You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
This is something that I think a lot of creators struggle with. It's like you make this great work, and then you think the world is like eagerly anticipating it, but they're not.
So people say, well, where should you focus? I think at some point you have to figure out what your umbrella is.
Most people can't answer the question, who is this actually for? Who is your fan? People go, leadership books are popular. I should write a leadership book. Well, that's a good way to get 1% of market. What you want is 100% of a market. So you have to think, what is the book that only I can write? If we're thinking about books or movie or restaurant, I'd be going, what is everyone else doing? And I want to do not that. That's probably the easiest place to start from.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Finding great talent can be tough. Thankfully, with our old friend and sponsor, ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners, you guys, can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James. That's ZipRecruiter.com/James. One more time to try for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/James. Today's episode is brought to you by Thumbtack. Thumbtack makes it easy to find and hire skilled professionals for anything on your list, from home improvement projects to event planning to personal wellness. Thumbtack connects you with professionals offering more than 1,100 different services nationwide. Boy, I want a massage, a haircut, home improvement. I'm going to use Thumbtack. Simply tell Thumbtack a little bit about your project. Then, within 24 hours, you'll have up to 5 estimates from local pros that match your criteria. Thumbtack makes it easy to find pros for pretty much anything you need done. Download the app or try it now at thumbtack.com. That's thumbtack.com. So, Ryan Holiday, once again on the podcast.
I know. You're going to have to tell me if I'm repeating myself at all, because I don't even remember what I've said all the other times.
I won't remember either.
Okay.
Oh, wait, but how many times now have you been on the podcast?
4 or 5.
Yeah, 4 or 5.
Yeah.
That's what I said to someone earlier. I think you've now eclipsed both Brian Koppelman and Tucker Max as most on the podcast.
That's pretty good company, so yes. I'll take it.
And we're talking about this great book that you have coming out, Perennial Seller. I know this is not the final copy. This is the uncorrected proof, Perennial Seller. The Art of Making, and I always forget subtitles. Did you come up with a subtitle? The Art of Making and Marketing Work That Lasts. And I think why I really like this book, you call it Perennial Seller, and you're obviously interested in books, and a lot of this is about how books become classics as opposed to just sort of forgotten or commercial successes that don't somehow become classics. But really, this applies to everything. It applies to business. It applies to ideas. It applies to any kind of creativity, art, restaurants, movies, anything. What else would you say it applies to, the ideas in this? Like, everybody who communicates should basically study the principles in this book.
I mean, we're in a recording studio. That's a drum set. I'm sure they have zildjian symbols here. They've been in business for 4 centuries. Which is insanity.
Wait, like, who's been in business
with zildjian symbols?
How do you spell that?
Z-I-L-D-J-I-N.
4 centuries they've been making drum symbols?
Yeah, since like 1623 is when they started. Fisker's Scissors, you know that? They've been a business for 5 centuries, 4 or 5 centuries. Sierre Tredone, which is a candle shop. They opened their first store in Manhattan in 2015, but they started making candles for Napoleon. So, like, there's all sorts of businesses that Katz's Delicatessen, 1888. You know, there's businesses that last. Not everything has to be trendy and then disappear. Things can last for generations.
And I feel like we live in a world, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you've said this in the book, we sort of live in this kind of what's trending in Twitter right now world, and we have to address this right now, and that's what's important. But really, all these things that you describe, plus the books you describe in the book, plus the musicians you describe in the book, plus the movies you describe in the book, all of these things seem to have some essence to them that hits something primal in us.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes something perennial, is the something primal that tends to last, that we remember from the age of 15 to 80, and then the next generation remembers it as well.
Yeah, so you take something like the publishing industry, which is a $70 billion a year industry, book publishing, and the vast majority of that revenue comes from things that are old.
Right, like most publishers survive on their backlist, mm-hmm. right? Like, you mentioned in the book, Catcher in the Rye still sells, this was published in 1951 or 52, mm-hmm. sells 1 million copies a year.
Right.
Like, how many books published this year will sell 1 million copies a year?
Not even how many books published this year will sell 1 million copies. How many books published this year will sell 1 million copies ever, right? So things, even though the vast majority of the income of the publishing industry is from the backlist, and in the music industry in 2015, the first year that catalog albums outsold new releases in that year, which is now going to be a trend going forward, the vast majority of energy of those industries are spent on, it's like the 80-20 principle reversed. They spend 80% of their energy on things that are responsible for 20% of their revenue. And then the thing that's responsible for 80% of the revenue, the old stuff, they just take for granted. They just assume that it happens, or they leave it alone.
It reminds me, actually, I was having dinner with a guy who, KKR, a big private mm-hmm. equity firm, gave him, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to buy the right. He had been a DJ. They gave him all this money to buy the rights to classic songs. Mm-hmm. And now he's got this like massively performing fund that just brings in money every year. So he's doing what you're saying. It's almost like he has a music company that only has the backlist.
Well, totally. And they actually, in the early 2000s, when David Bowie was still alive, they came up with something called the Bowie Bond,
yeah,
which is like his catalog makes X amount per year. So why is he waiting for that? Why can't he raise a bond on those future earnings? And a bunch of bands did this. Iron Maiden did this, David Bowie, a couple other big groups. They were like, look, this is a dependable asset like gold or real estate. Why can't I borrow against the future earnings of my royalties? And, you know, Michael Jackson's estate has made something like $1 billion since his death, not from just from Michael Jackson songs, but the fact that he assembled a huge catalog.
Like the Beatles.
And he bought the Beatles catalog, not because he stole it from the Beatles, but he thought it was worth more than Paul McCartney did. And so that's where the income is, ultimately, is in dependable, perennial intellectual property.
So separating it out from, well, actually, let's give a couple specific examples first, and then I want to figure out what is that essence that makes something perennial. So you have such great examples, and some of it I don't quite understand.
Okay.
Actually, maybe I'll hit the one that I don't understand the most. So Avatar, you point out, is the most commercially successful movie ever.
Yeah.
And yet we can't remember a single line from it. As opposed to, like, let's say The Godfather, which I probably watch The Godfather every single year.
Sure.
You know, I probably watched it 20 or 30, or Star Wars, I probably watch every single year.
Right.
Or Schindler's List or something like that. But Avatar I've seen once and I will never see it again.
Sure. So Avatar is definitely, like, I'm not saying that Avatar wasn't successful. Clearly, it's the most successful movie of all time in its theatrical run. But by nature of the fact that its primary appeal was its technological advancements, not its timeless story and not its resonance. It if you look at its revenue, it probably goes like this and then down, unless, you know, there's a sequel. Maybe it'll become more. He's obviously thinking about doing more, but it's a fundamentally different story than, say, The Shawshank Redemption, which starts off slow, or Star Wars, which is beaten by Smokey and the Bandit at the box office.
I didn't know that also. That was in your book, too.
Yeah.
And so that weekend, you mean, it was beaten?
Yes. But by the way, I owe you, because I found out that fact from Cass Sunstein's book, which you recommended that I read.
It's called The World According to Star Wars.
And so it's like, not only did it get beaten its opening weekend, but it's and then went on to make a lot of money. But the revenue of Star Wars is actually accelerating. Like, today, it's probably worth more than it was 5 years ago, because it's adding fans, it's accumulating all these different income streams. So it's not that things can't be successful right now, and that everything that's successful right now is a fad. But my point is that there's this sort of there's this elephant in the room of all the creative industries, that really the money is in the things that stand the test of time, that last. They're cheaper to make, they're less risky to make, they're less sexy, but they're also the most dependable. Like,
so wait, I want to understand Avatar versus Star Wars.
Sure.
Because if I tell you something, a movie that was on the cutting edge of special effects, a reluctant hero, a semi-love story, a guy who encounters all sorts of problems with aliens and, you know, saves the world as a result, that kind of describes both movies.
It does, it's a timeless story.
It
does, but I'm not sure. Avatar isn't explicitly based on the hero's journey, and it's also not designed to create a community, right? I think what Star Wars did, and this is much later in the perennial process, but I do think it's important, is like, can you build a community of hardcore fans around that work? It's like, everyone saw Avatar when it came out, so it didn't really do anything for a specific group of people, right? So, like, I saw Iron Maiden play in San Antonio 2 days ago, and that's my third time seeing them. They've been a band for 40 years. They haven't been on the radio in 30 years, and there was 20,000 people in this arena, and it was just us. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not for everyone. It's just for us.
So what is... before I ask again, what is the essence of an Iron Maiden or a Star Wars versus these other things? Another great example, so we've talked about books, movies, you've mentioned some businesses, you just mentioned music, but like TV shows, you have a great example, two shows that were around the same time, both commercially successful, Seinfeld versus Friends, Seinfeld has literally coined like new phrases in the language. Yeah. You know, people say yada, 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 or they say, oh, there's so many phrases that they say. And Friends, it's like you say, we kind of forget now.
What it was all about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I think it, to a certain degree, there is a certain secret or magic to great stuff. So I grant that. But I would say that I think one of the differences is that one was trying to be the popular show right then, and I think the other was looking at things on a larger horizon. Seinfeld is written with a stand-up comic's eye for sort of timeless, funny, perennial problems of life, right? The low talker, the high talker, the you know, who do you tip, how do you tip? You know, all these...
What are the rules of society?
Exactly. And Friends is about ephemera, right? Like, Friends is about... It's the episode of Friends where they're going to a Hootie and the Blowfish concert, and the episode of Friends where, you know, this happens or that. It's the... Friends is about, you know, Ross's relationship with Rachel and Chandler's relationship with Monica. I would say Seinfeld, again, we're just looking at this from the outside. Seinfeld is about the character's relation to the world around them, the same world that we all operate in. Like,
but can we say this in, as you kind of just alluded to, can we say this in, are we saying this in retrospect? Like, obviously relationships are important and relatable to everybody and continue to be. And, you know, Seinfeld and Elaine and George and Kramer had a very New York view of the world that isn't always relatable, and yet mainstream America and the entire world somehow related to it.
But I think it's rooted in Jerry Seinfeld's comedic Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David's comedic understanding of the absurdity of life. Like, the absurdity of Friends is, how do all these people without jobs live in this ridiculous apartment and do these things, right?
So it wasn't real in that sense.
It's not real. It's not believable. And it doesn't, it only exists, it only makes sense inside the preposterous universe of network television, right? And there's absurd elements of Seinfeld. So I'm not saying, like, Kramer's a very unreal person, but Kramer is also based on Larry David's actual roommate or actual neighbor. And so it's actually a lot of the great plots on Seinfeld are based on things that actually happened to Jerry and Larry.
Well, you know, not only that, when Larry started to run out of stories, what he would do is every year he would fire all the writers, bring a new set of writers in from New York and get their stories.
Sure.
He'd interview based on how funny their New York stories were.
Interesting.
And then he'd, as opposed to having a writer's room, he'd send everybody off to write their stories. And then he and Jerry would rewrite all the scripts to be Seinfeldian.
Yes.
And then the next year, he'd just have a new slew of writers in.
So I think that makes complete sense. And I think when you're looking at Seinfeld, they were resisting all of the things that that Friends gave into. There's the Brad Pitt cameo on Friends. There's no celebrity cameos on Seinfeld for the most part, right?
Right. There's a New York Mets player. I forget his name.
Right. But even that was like sort of, it wasn't like, oh, there's a Mets player. You know, it's not, they're not doing the things for Sweeps Week, right? They're resisting the temptation. And you see this as an author too, when you work with a publisher. They're trying to root you in what's going on right now. They're like, well, talk about this. You know, what about this? You know, like, if you wrote a book right now about any form of communication or politics or culture, your publisher would try to get you to talk about Trump. He's the elephant in the room.
Right.
But in 4 years, is he still the elephant in the room? In 8 years, is he the elephant in the room? You know, so I think Seinfeld, by nature of Jerry and Larry's sort of creative vision for the show and their control over it, and the fact that it was sort of underwhelming at first, so it was sort of forgotten, allowed them to put in place some cultural practices that let them be resistant of the crap that is on, that ruins so many network shows.
Or ruins everything, right?
Sure,
so,
right.
So like, what are some of those barriers that you could put up around your work to avoid? Because obviously, this is not saying you want to be, like, I feel like there's this sort of snobbishness or elitism that people say, oh, this is for me, or, you know, about, this is my art. But really, Seinfeld was, you know, hundreds of millions of people enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that putting these barriers up prevent people from enjoying your work. It's almost the opposite.
You have to protect the purity of what you're doing to a certain degree. I think it is important. You have to believe that this is something more than just like a commercial product, or more than just this thing that you're doing. And so I think Seinfeld managed to, and just the fact that Seinfeld quit when he felt like it wasn't going to be good anymore or that it was too much is, I think, an indication of the kind of principles that undergirded the show throughout its 7 or 8 seasons. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Friends didn't leave the air because the people thought it was getting redundant or unnecessary, right? They were like, how long can we keep this show on the air? But Seinfeld was different.
Yeah, somehow there is something more precious about it, in the sense that, you know, Seinfeld even says, there was an interview between Howard Stern and Jerry Seinfeld where Howard Stern said, everybody wanted you to continue. Yeah. Like, everybody in America wanted you to continue. Right. And Jerry Seinfeld said, that's why they're not writing
exactly
the top show in the world.
Right, so, right. So you have to go into these things knowing what you're trying to do so you can know what not to do. Because there's, like, I think people think that it's hard to do these things, and it is, but it also there's all the, it's like you almost have too many ideas. There's all these things that you can do. You can throw in a show or in a book or in a project because people are going to be giving you suggestions. You have to know which are too far. Do you know what I mean? I think when Brian Koppelman was on your podcast, it might have been this, your podcast or another one, but he was talking about, like, they would when they went out with Rounders, people were like, there's too much dialogue in
right.
this. And he's like, that's the whole fucking point. You know what I mean? So you have to know that is.
He said something that's very interesting that you inadvertently also repeated in this book, which is you've got to write what interests you.
Yes.
And which is very different from the usual advice, which is write what you know.
Yeah.
If you don't write what interests you, it's just going to fall flat. You're not going to be able to pick up on all the subtleties and nuances that are important. I think a part of what makes something perennial is that you understand all the nuances of what you're doing better than anyone else does.
Right.
So everybody's able to somehow key into something, but they don't even know what it is they're keying into.
Yeah.
Like, take Iron Maiden as an example. What is the essence of what makes Iron Maiden perennial, as opposed to many other metal bands that were out around the same time? I mean, they were kind of like the originators of metal almost, but there were still other hard rock bands that started at exactly the same time.
I think what one of the things that Iron Maiden was lucky in that they never got popular, like they never were on the radio.
But they sold 80 million copies of their albums.
Yes, but not in, they didn't sell 80 million albums in 1980 and now they sell a couple thousand a year. It's like they sell a million albums a year. Do you know what, today? So I think they, in some ways they got lucky that, you know, like when hair metal was popular, Iron Maiden was a big band, but they weren't part of that crowd. And then when grunge happened, they weren't part of that crowd. And when indie rock, you know, they were always on the outside, so they were just doing their own thing. They were like,
but compare them again though to like Guns N' Roses, which still,
but
which
Guns
is
N' Roses
almost
is a radio band. Guns N' Roses is a radio band. Like Guns N' Roses had many number one hits. Iron Maiden has basically only had number one albums because their fans bought them. Like, Iron Maiden has 3 guitarists. That's absurd. You don't need 3 guitarists, but that's what they wanted to do. You know, Iron Maiden writes 8-minute songs about Alexander the Great or Genghis Khan. These are things that you don't do if you're trying to be on MTV or be on the radio. But if that's what your fans like, that's what you do. So I think they made this self-contained universe that was logically consistent and amazing if you're into it. And they... You know, Rick Rubin has this quote. He says, you know, the best art divides the audience. Half the people think Iron Maiden is a joke and the other half think it's awesome, you know?
It's so funny. Somebody once told me, actually Naval Ravikant, who's been a guest on the podcast, he once told me that the best-selling books tend to be the ones with an equal number of 5 stars and 1 stars because they're so controversial. And I don't know if it's true or not, but it makes sense.
My first book, I remember the head of PR or social media at Ford posted a picture on Twitter of it in his trash can. Huh. Like, he was like, this book is a piece of shit. I hate this person. You know, he hated it. Huh. And when I saw that, I was like, that's exactly the person that I want to piss off because I'm saying that his sort of utopian social media is changing the world for the better vision is totally wrong.
So, okay, so let's dive deeper into this, that Iron Maiden or you with your first book, you have or Seinfeld with their show, they had a certain set of principles, mm-hmm. right? So Seinfeld, the principles were the show's about nothing. Yes. We're going to observe all these weird rules in society and critical, nobody learns anything at the end.
Yes.
Which was very different from a lot of sitcoms.
Right, right.
Like, you know, every other sitcom would have like, you know, something funny and something bad would happen and yeah. the family would all learn to be closer together by right. the end. Seinfeld, nobody learns anything.
Sure.
And they stuck to that. And Iron Maiden, they stuck to there are three guitars. We're going to do the music we want to do and mm-hmm. say things we want to say. Now, many people have beliefs sure. and belief systems, and it doesn't always work out that sure. they sell 80 million copies right. of whatever. So what's the next thing that separates out a perennial from the has-beens? Because I would say 90% sure. are still that, 99% are still the has-beens.
So if we put marketing aside, because I think marketing is an essential part of this, but if we're just talking about the creative process first, I think a lot of people go into making things and they don't think about whether there's actually an audience for this or not, right? So like when, you know, the entrepreneur thing is you scratch your own itch. That's like not that great of an advice because you're the only, like you don't want to make something for one person. Like, so I think most people go into something and they don't think, they can't answer the question, who is this actually for? Right? Like, who is your fan? And are there a lot of, you know, are there a lot of them? Are there 10 of them? Are there 10 of them, but there's a new one born every year? You know, what is the audience for this thing? I think that's a very essential element. The other element, I think, and you had Peter Thiel on the podcast, it's this idea of avoiding competition, right? So people go, lots of people are writing leadership books. Leadership books are popular. I should write a leadership book. Well, that's a good way to get 1% of a market. Do you know what I mean? What you want is 100% of a market. And you have to think, what is the book that only I can write if we're thinking about books or movie or restaurant? Like, don't open another coffee shop. Open something that only you can open.
Right. So let's taking Seinfeld again. People who have all the skills in, let's say, observational comedy yeah. and humor and writing. Like, it turned out Larry David had this unusually clever skill at sitcom writing. Mm-hmm. And combined with the fact that they took the entire genre, and it's not like they changed the genre. You even point this out. It's not like they're still a 22-minute show.
Right.
They fit many of the tropes of a sitcom. Yeah. But they moved it forward somehow. They did something that no one else had done. For instance, right. they have storylines for every single character, which they tie together at the end. No yeah. sitcom had done that before. They don't learn anything. No yeah. sitcom had really done that before.
Or even saying, this is a show about nothing. Every show was about something before, right? This is about family. This is about, you know, working in the, you know, whatever. It's the idea of like, oh, we're going to have a show about... It's like, and actually, that's the famous impetus of Seinfeld is Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld are in like a bodega in New York City and they're making fun of stuff and having fun. And then Larry says, this is what the show should be. And he says, what? And he's like, you know, this, just making fun of stuff, right? That is a stroke of innovation. That's the creation of a blue ocean in comedy sitcoms.
And they had evidence too. It wasn't like two random guys making fun of lettuce yes. who said we should make a show about this. I mean, they had been on, you know, between the Tonight Show and Saturday Night Live
yes.
and they had already tested out
he's
the fact that
he's in front of an audience every night. He yeah. knows people like him making fun of stuff.
Right, and he knows that his observations are good enough for a national audience.
Yes.
So there's a way to test it. Like, how did Iron Maiden, let's say... And again, I always wonder about this thing. It's not, let's say you're going to start a band. It's not good enough, or let's say you're going to write a leadership book.
Yeah.
It's not good enough to be 20 or 30% better than everyone else.
Right.
Because the average reader doesn't know the difference between 30% better and the average leadership book or the average sitcom or the average
totally.
Band. They might know the difference if you're 10 times better or if you're somehow creating your own, a new genre or
sure.
whatever, but they're not going to notice 30% better, even 50% better. So how does an Iron Maiden, which didn't necessarily have an opportunity to test, how did they become 10 times better than
sure.
the other bands out there?
So Iron Maiden is part of a movement called the New Wave of British Heavy Metal. So they sort of take the world by storm. It's this totally new take. You know, like, it's you have Led Zeppelin and Thin Lizzy, that's like, that's metal or that's rock music. And then when you get to the Iron Maidens and the Judas Priests of the world, it's fundamentally different. So there is, and music is a little different because I think there's less competition in music, but it is a fundamentally new innovation. It's like sort of two guitar driven. It's got big over the top singing. It was an innovative band. And then what they add to that is the imagery and the artwork and this sort of self-contained universe around the stuff. I think there's a number of musical innovations in Iron Maiden, definitely. But I think you make a good point. What I see a lot of, like when I'll deal with companies, they'll go like, this is like Facebook, but it's better for this reason. Do you know what I mean? Or when I'll give you an example with my own writing. When I decided to write a book about Stoicism, I looked at all the different books. I'd read everything there ever was about Stoicism. I'd read all the originals and I'd read all the books about it. And I basically realized there was nothing that I could just add. You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't, my big beef with all the books in the space were that they were just repeating what the originals had said in a way that wasn't interesting to the vast majority of ordinary people.
Right. So I've read your book on Stoicism and the two other, let's say, main contemporary books on Stoicism. So I'll try to remember the names. The one by William Irving. And then the one by Massimo,
the How to Be a Stoic one?
Yeah. So I've read those. And in your words.
I can talk about this.
Yeah.
So I think Massimo's book is very good. I blurbed it. I think he's a good person. I'm glad he wrote it. I think it's a mistake to put Stoic in the title of the book. I mean, I wrote a book called The Daily Stoic, but that is for a very specific niche of people. Mm-hmm. I think it was a mistake to put Stoic in the title because people don't like the word Stoic.
Or they don't want to read about Greek philosophy.
Exactly. I sold a book about Stoicism to my publisher, and then I had to sit down and go, okay, what is this book? How do I write it so it reaches a large audience and helps lots of people? And I sat down and I said, very few people wake up in the morning and think, I have a problem, I need philosophy. But a lot of people wake up in the morning and think, I have problems, I need solutions. So if I can present philosophy as a solution to the problem, I can reach those people. If I present it as philosophy, they will think it's not for them.
Right.
And so that to me is the one of the most essential parts of thinking about creating any creative work, and specifically creating work that lasts, is going, here's what I want to do, but what's the best way for me to get at that, right? It's like a lawyer sits down to make their argument. They don't just throw a lot of evidence at you. They go, what are the best pieces of evidence? What's the best way for me to make my case?
So part of it is, like, and let's look at that Stoicism example again. So your book was called The Obstacle is the Way.
Right.
And then an excellent follow-up, Ego is the Enemy, is also related to Stoicism. Uh-huh. You basically had a bunch of tools at your disposal. It wasn't like you're kind of out of the blue thinking, oh, I'm going to write about Stoicism and philosophy. You had one tool, which is you knew the whole, not only the history of Stoicism, but the history of books being written about Stoicism and how they did. So you wanted to make something that was different from them.
Yeah.
And you thought about it in a certain way. This other thing you had was you saw and you helped create kind of the success of many other writers, like, let's say, Robert Greene or Tim Ferriss or Tucker Max, where you helped them market their books and do their research in some cases. So you saw the thinking process of people who tried, like Robert Greene wrote a book about leadership that's different from any other book about leadership.
Completely.
He created his own genre of like diving into the lessons of history without writing a history book or writing specifically a leadership book. He called it The 48 Laws of Power, which is a very unusual title too.
Sure.
So it reminds me of...
But wait, I had one other tool. Also, I'd also built up an audience of fans, right? So I'm not launching to no one, right? I think that's the other element. It's like, you know, Seinfeld isn't the first thing that Jerry Seinfeld does. He has fans all over the country. He has fans inside the network at NBC. You know what I mean? It's about your relationships and your audience and all these things that also help you launch. It's easier to launch a perennial seller later in your career than it is as your first thing, let's say.
Because of, like you point out just then, it was just as important for Seinfeld to have fans within the network as he had fans, fans obviously from The Tonight Show. Now, again, Seinfeld didn't do so well its first season.
Right.
And the kind of the saying that's always made, I don't know if it's true or not, if Seinfeld were made today, it probably would have been canceled the first season with low ratings.
But maybe it wouldn't, because maybe he would have had the same allies at NBC who would have given him that chance. You know, right. Like you need, like my... When The Obstacle Is the Way came out, it didn't sell super well at first. It sold okay, but the publisher was invested in me, and they'd already bought my next book.
Which, by the way, is very rare for a publisher now to be invested in an author.
Like, and I think that's a mistake.
They don't really think of investing in careers. They want to invest in as many books as possible, and one of them might be a hit.
Yeah, and I think that's a mistake, and I think because of that, they have to publish more and more books to get luckier and luckier. And, you know, it's like my books sell, you know, let's say 5,000 copies a week across the titles. But that's actually an easier target to hit than to have one book that sells 5,000 copies week in and week out, right? And I would, to go back to the Stoicism discussion, I would say what's interesting about competition, and again, Peter Thiel talks about this all the time. I think everyone who's creating should read Zero to One and think about this, is like, his publisher, Massimo's publisher, probably looked at the sales of my two books or my three books on Stoicism and said, oh, this is also a book about Stoicism, so this book will sell really well. And it has sold well, and I'm happy for him how it's doing. But people associate competition with like rewards, and it's actually the area you don't want to be in. Because now his book is fighting my books for sales, right? As opposed to being in his own niche where he's the only one.
And by the way, until you just said that, I thought his book was older than your book because it's about ancient Greek philosophy.
Right.
So it feels like one of those old school academic kind of books.
Sure.
So, you know, it reminds me also, and you don't mention this perennial, you don't go into the art world in this book as much, but like think about Andy Warhol. Mm-hmm. So Andy Warhol was already maybe the best illustrator in New York City. The guy had magnificent technique, and he could look at anything and draw it, and it would be perfect.
Right.
And so he already knew he could be a great artist, and he already had the personality. He was already creating a scene around himself, but he needed something to do. So he was thinking of taking old 1950s comic books and doing something kind of kitschy with them. Mm-hmm. But then he saw Roy Lichtenstein was doing it, so he couldn't do it.
Right.
He switched to the Campbell's soup cans,
right,
and created his own kind of genre, sure, of pop art. And so that's another example where he had the skills,
right,
he had the scene, he had the network, he just needed to do something that was kind of that, not 50% better, like not doing comic books better than Roy Lichtenstein,
right,
but just something completely different.
Well, and I think people need to realize that I think a lot of artists think that this is like the business part of things. Like you make your art and then maybe you think about these things later. Mm. To me, this is the most important part of the creative process. This is the puzzle that I find to be most intellectually and creatively challenging, right? It's like, what can I make? How do I make it? What's the best way to do it? You know, what's going to be the most interesting? What's going to be the newest, you know? And I think people go, well, I want to write about a book about this, so I'm going to write a book about that. And then, you know, once it's done, then I'll figure out what title to put on it. I'll figure out what cover to put on it. And then I'll get some publicity and it'll sell. And it's like, if they accidentally got all the things that we're talking about right, sure. But they didn't stop and go, who is this for? What's the best way to tackle it? Is there competition? Who am I launching this to? You know, these are really essential questions that you have to think about. I remember we met probably not far from here in New York City, and we talked about Choose Yourself when you were thinking about doing it. And we had a number, you know, we talked about the title, and I think nailing the title was a huge part of it. I remember we talked about, you know, you wanted it to be this self-help book, which it is, but we had a conversation about what the intro should be, that the intro should be rooted in, you know, this larger economic reality of the collapse of jobs and the collapse.
Right.
You know, you have this, you tell that story in the beginning of the book about looking out at the buildings and going, this is all empty. And that was rooted in, you know, sort of the post-financial crisis, but it's also just, it's a larger economic trend that transcends just like that one moment in time.
And tied in with my personal story.
Yes, and your expertise and all these things. I think choose yourself without that introduction. It just goes into why you should choose yourself or the art of choosing yourself or, you know, whatever. I think that book doesn't do as well. So I right. think these are really important decisions that people think they can tack on later, but it's impossible to tack them on later. You can't open a coffee shop and then go, actually, this is a co-working space, right? It's like you have to decide at the beginning.
Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Thumbtack. Thumbtack makes it easy to find and hire skilled local professionals for anything on your list of things to do or things that you need, from home improvement projects to event planning to personal wellness. Thumbtack connects you with professionals offering more than 1,100 different services nationwide. Simply tell Thumbtack a little bit about your project. Then within 24 hours, you'll have up to 5 estimates from local pros that match your criteria. Check out their prices and reviews. Pretty much anyone you need to hire is on Thumbtack. Carpet cleaners, personal trainers, photographers, even piano teachers. Anyway, Thumbtack will help you find pros in over 1,000 different categories in all 50 states. Thumbtack has so many services available. True story, I recently used Thumbtack to fix my computer. It was easy. I just went to thumbtack.com, I searched for computer, and then the rest of the keywords just sort of filled themselves in. So I clicked computer repair, and they immediately told me there were 200 plus people in my area who could do the job. Seriously, no matter the project, you'll find the help you need on Thumbtack. Thumbtack makes it easy to find pros for pretty much anything you need done. Download the app or try it now at thumbtack.com. That's thumbtack.com. Are you hiring? Because I kind of think you might be. Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Finding great talent can be tough. Thankfully, with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. Then, their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, it finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James. That's ZipRecruiter.com/James. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/James. So you mentioned Catcher in the Rye mm-hmm. in your book. And at the time, could you have said, I mean, nobody could have said, but you know, when he wrote it, it just seemed like this coming of age story of a privileged Upper East Side kid named Holden Caulfield. You know, where's the perennial aspects there? Maybe there wasn't such an extreme coming of age story at the time, but do you think he consciously went through kind of what's the history of coming of age stories? How do I make the next leap in that genre?
Well, from what I understand about Salinger is that he had this sort of weird childhood, and then he was profoundly affected by what he saw in World War II. Like, people don't realize, like, he almost certainly came back with some form of PTSD. I mean, he served in what's called the Hürtgen Forest, I believe, which is one of the most brutal, horrible fighting of the Second World War. And so he came back kind of like frozen in time. Like his inner child was sort of like frozen. Do you know what I mean? And so I think it's not that it's a coming of age story, which is a perennial genre. It's that he wrote a book that captures what it means to feel like an angsty young person. I watched that documentary about the book, and Jake Gyllenhaal is in it for some reason, and he says that Catcher in the Rye is like the autobiography of Malcolm X for young white boys. And it's totally right. So it's perennial in that sense, in that every year there's somebody, every year hundreds of thousands or millions of people all over the world turn 16.
But I feel like he couldn't have planned that. Like, so if you're—
But he was capturing an essence that he was speaking about, a truth of the human experience that no one had yet spoken to. There was no book before Catcher in the Rye that speaks to that experience the way that he did. So I think that's part of it. But as I do talk about in the book, and this is where I think positioning and packaging matter, you know, he saw that book as this important work of literary greatness. You know, it's in the New Yorker or whatever. The reason that book became really popular is because it had a pulp cut. That book became a success in paperback, and it had this salacious cover of Holden Caulfield standing outside of a strip club. And I'm forgetting the tagline, but I can find it for you. He has this tagline in the book that's amazing, and it says, let's see here. We can talk about something else if you want, but it says, this unusual book may shock you, will make you laugh, and may break your heart, but you will never forget it. That's the subtitle of The Catcher in the Rye on the pulp paperback. So that book blew up, not because it was this highbrow literary thing, but because it was this sort of low, grungy, almost salacious art at first.
So at the same time, look at his network. So he didn't necessarily have a huge audience of fans, or although maybe he did, but he had already published a bunch of stories in the New Yorker. Mm-hmm. So he had kind of like his literary network all laid out. He did have some fans from his readers of his short stories.
Yeah.
So he had put some time into building that, you know, 1950s version of a platform.
Yeah. And though I wouldn't underestimate the paperback part of things, and this is something that I think a lot of creators struggle with. It's like you make this great work, and then you think the world is like eagerly anticipating it, but they're not. You know, Raymond Chandler is considered the greatest detective story writer ever, not just because he wrote these great books, but because he embraced the paperback and he sold his books really, really cheaply, and it allowed him to develop a mass audience. So I think being willing to go mass market to reach lots of people is also one of the ways to create some level of lasting, right? Like if you're not, like people don't like to give their work away for free. Publishers hate that. You know, musicians want to get paid. You know, like we're anti-free in the artistic community, or anti-cheap because we think it devalues our art. But that's also how you develop a crowd. That's how you reach the people who become the hardcore fans of your work.
Right. You point out Paulo Coelho actively
pirates his own work.
Yeah, he sends to other countries. Mm-hmm. He goes on all the pirating sites and gives away for free,
right?
Just so people know him. And then, how many copies of his books has he sold?
Literally hundreds of millions. Yeah. You know, I give away almost over when the obstacle. Since The Obstacle Is the Way has come out, I think I've given away at least one thing from each chapter in some form of an article. But each one of those is selling. You know, it's like if you make something that's good, the best sales pitch for that thing is that thing. But we don't realize the burden that it takes to get to it. You know what I mean? You don't know that you love a restaurant until you eat there. So if it's expensive, you might not eat there at first. Or you don't know that you like a movie until you've seen it. But it's a pain in the ass to go see a movie. So in some ways, piracy or innovative marketing techniques helps you reach that audience, which you ultimately need to have an audience over the long term. I found Iron Maiden because I was in 2001, I was trying to pirate a Metallica song on Kazaa or Morpheus, one of the pirating sites, and I downloaded an Iron Maiden song on accident, and then I loved it, and I've since spent literally thousands of dollars on their stuff. Do you know what I mean? And since they weren't on the radio in 2001, that would have been the only way that I could really discover them.
So a lot of this stuff, like let's say with Catcher in the Rye, a lot of these things are just kind of circumstances.
Yeah.
Are a big part of what makes something perennial.
Uh-huh.
And yet we all, every artist, creator, business person, anybody who has to communicate an idea, and now communication is so much more important just because there's Twitter, there's Facebook, there's books, there's articles, there's everything. There's all these open source platforms. It's so hard to stand out. Mm-hmm. Like how do we move beyond the basic circumstances of our lives to try to actively create something perennial?
Well, and what I try to do in my writing is try to look at things that have happened in history, or in this case, in the history of art and creativity, and go, this might have been accidental, or this might have been unconscious for the person doing it, but that doesn't mean that you can't take a lesson from it and apply it, right? So it's like, Salinger actually didn't want to be a pulp paperback, and as soon as he had the power with the publisher to revert back to the famous red cover of The Catcher in the Rye, he did, but it was also instrumental in his success. So what I'm not saying is that he created Catcher in the Rye as a perennial seller on purpose, and he knew how this thing would play out with paperbacks, but that doesn't mean you can't borrow that strategy in your own career. So I think that's part of it. But I think in terms of breaking out, part of this is just one of the ways to break out of the noise is to go where there's less noise, right? So that's why that the decision to avoid competition to do something new is a creative decision, but ultimately a marketing decision as well, or has marketing implications. I think being willing to attack the status quo, to say things that are controversial, to take risks, to be brash and bold, I think that's important too. Like, again, when Rick Rubin is saying the best art divides the audience, he's saying you have to be okay with half or a significant portion of people not liking your stuff. And you can do that if you know who your stuff is for. So it's like, I know...
So you have to have a certain honesty internally to know who your stuff is for.
Yes.
You can't be...
For everyone.
You can't be overly commercial.
Yes.
Even though you want commercial success.
Yes.
Well, let's take something that's overly commercial. Like, let's say The Firm by John Grisham. Uh-huh. That's probably a perennial seller. Like, yeah, John definitely. Grisham is the top of the heap in terms of, like, legal thrillers, and they continue to sell, and he always does well. What do you think... So he wasn't even the first legal thriller guy. Like, there was Scott Turow, there was a couple other people. But what do you think really broke it out for him?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think he did two self-published books before that that didn't really sell.
A Time to Kill, and I think The Firm might have been self-published.
So it's not as if he certainly was not, like, people like, oh, it's a commercial book. No one thought it was commercial when it came out. So it's like, you got to give him, it actually was probably bold and brave to do what he was doing. Like, he was doing what everyone else said wouldn't work. So I think that's part of it. And look, Ian Fleming, there's a wonderful book which you would love. I might have recommended this already, but it's called Man with the Golden Typewriter. And it's Ian Fleming, who created James Bond. It's his letters. When his first book was successful, he rewarded himself by buying a golden typewriter. But he talks about this. It's like he was like, look, the James Bond books are doing well. They're selling well. He knew that fundamentally the way that his stuff would get taken to the next level was movies. So a lot of his letters are about his maneuvering and strategy and work. He's like, look, I'm going to keep selling. I'm going to be an okay, successful author. But if I want to be like a world-changing, massive author, I got to get these books to the screen. Well, I wonder if that was part of it with The Firm.
Which reminds me also of, you know, a lot of what you write about is about doing as opposed to just writing or thinking or whatever. And a lot of your marketing around the books that you've done have been about doing things almost that are unrelated to the book. But when you do something... That's what people write about. People are not going to write about the contents of another piece of writing.
Right.
They're going to write about something you do. Yeah. So
there's very little press that goes, new book is out, you know? But, you know, new author runs naked through Times Square, that's a thing, and you might get attention for that.
Well, when we were brainstorming back in 2013 about Choose Yourself, the marketing wasn't really about the contents of the book, and the value of the book was going to speak for itself once people read it. But we were always thinking of what could we do around it. So, for instance, I attempted to run for Congress, or I sold the book. And you mentioned this in Perennial Seller. I attempted to sell the book just Bitcoin only at first, and that got me, you know, national attention.
I should have bought Bitcoin when you did that. I should have bought Bitcoin when you did that. I wouldn't need to even be here or write any books anymore.
The Bitcoin has done well since then. But I always think it's about, you know, a lot of companies now talk about content marketing mm-hmm. instead of advertising.
Right.
They're like, oh, let's write about what we believe right. in instead of just have a big banner.
Yeah.
But I don't even think content marketing is
good
anymore.
Because most of it's boring.
Yeah.
Right.
You have to actually do stuff.
Right. No, they should be, you know, like with American Apparel, I remember, I think I mentioned this in the book, one of the big things the company did was it took a stand on immigration. It pissed a lot of people off, but it created a whole political campaign about wanting immigration reform, like liberal immigration reform, not Trump immigration reform. But in doing so, it got a ton of its advertising got publicity, right? When you do things, you can get publicity. And so it's important, but it's important. You have to know who your fans are so you can be, you can know what they want and what they're going to agree with. And then you can know who your not fans are. And then you can know that you don't have to care what those people think.
I think that's really critical because there is the tendency in today's world, everybody could comment.
Yeah.
Right. So you put up a YouTube video, everyone's going to comment.
Right.
And people always say, oh, I ignore the YouTube comments, whatever.
Right.
But sometimes a negative comment will just by accident hit
sure.
that nerve
right.
and will bother you.
Right. Or, I mean, companies are now like hostage to their own social media stuff where, you know, there's advertiser boycotts, which just started happening. They don't realize that the people that are starting the advertiser boycott aren't their customers and don't even care about this thing. They're just trying to apply pressure. And so if you know who your customers are, you know which controversies are important and you know which ones are meaningless.
You bring up something really interesting with Star Wars, which I think applies to a lot of perennial works. And I'll even relate Star Wars to The Legend of Bagger Vance by uh-huh. our mutual friend
yep.
Stephen Pressfield, which is take an old ancient story that's been, and I always use this phrase, an ancient, like the story of Jesus Christ has been focus grouped for mm-hmm. successfully for 2,000 years
sure.
by a billion people.
Right.
So a billion people have been in the focus group and said this, not only do they like it, they love it, they believe
right.
in it, they have faith in it. And so essentially George Lucas took that story and mm-hmm. made it and put a science fiction trapping around it.
Right.
Legend of Bagger Vance, which Stephen Pressfield's even admitted, it's a golf story that takes place in the 1920s, but almost word for word, or at least scene by scene, he borrows from a 3,000-year-old Hindu document
sure.
called the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
So when you take these old stories and put them in a modern cloak, that also has a strong feeling on people. Because we know
completely.
The feeling worked.
But I think that's a really important artistic and marketing decision, right? It's to Stephen Pressfield obviously sat down and said, I love that story, but it's not going to work if I tell it as it's told originally. That he said, but you know, 1920s golf is that's nostalgic, it's beautiful, it's American, it's all he saw that if he took this thing and put it in this context, it would reach an audience, right? And so like with Stoicism, Stoicism is is my personal philosophy. It's how I think about, I nerd out about it. But I realize that most people don't think that way and are not interested in that. Like, it's like, just as the story of Jesus Christ has been focus grouped for 3,000 years, the word Stoic has been focus grouped for 2,000 years, and people think it's a bad thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I say he stood there stoically while his mother died, you know, they'd be like, why wasn't he crying? Like, they would think that you're a monster, you mm-hmm. know? So I was saying, this is what I like, this is what I'm interested in, but it's not the context. It has a context or an appearance that is at first alienating to people who could benefit from it. So what is a context that I could give it to people that it would be more palatable and, you know, what's the sugar with the medicine, right? And so the idea of stories, of great stories from great men and women from history, those stories have also been focus grouped. So I'm going to pick the stories that match the principles and put them together in a context. And I know that genre of books has worked well in the past. I know it's something I've experienced.
Robert Greene's technique, for instance,
exactly.
in all of his books.
Right. Robert Greene doesn't tell you what the 48 laws of power are. He shows you how the 48 laws of power work. And so that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to go Seneca says you should do this. I wanted to take something that Seneca said and illustrate it by principles. Now, this is also a this is what Plutarch does, right? This is what all the great Roman and Greek biographers have done. But for some reason, a lot of the people who are really into Stoicism don't like that. Like, they think that I've done something wrong or it upsets them, which is totally fine. But they're not who I was writing a book for. So it doesn't bother. Like, when they say, you know, Ryan is taking, I see this criticism all the time. They'll go, Ryan took someone like Rockefeller, who's a bad person, and tried to illustrate Stoicism through his life. That's why you shouldn't read this book. And I go, yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to do and exactly why it's resonating with a large audience. And you're entirely missing the point. Do you know what I mean? And so it's like, I know what my audience, the audience I'm trying to reach, needs. And I know that the best art divides the audience, right? There is a cost to that. And the cost is that the purists don't like it, or we call them the fundamentalists in the Stoic community. It's not for them, or they don't think it's for them because it's not for them.
So part of it is, again, understanding the history of the genre. So there's been a history of books written about philosophy and Stoicism and what worked and what didn't. Then it's understanding what ideas have resonated through and survived the test of time, and then kind of showing them in a modern kind of next generation way. So Star Wars, you could say, I'm simplifying it, because it's more the Joseph Campbell's The Ark of the Hero. Mm-hmm. But like with Star Wars, essentially, takes the story of Jesus and turns it into a science fiction format. So no matter what religion you are, you don't recognize that. He doesn't say, you know, this guy is Anakin is Jesus or whatever. He just does the story. Yeah. And
then he says, hey, when people go to the movies, they like to see fight scenes and spaceships, and they like to see technology, and they also like jokes, you know? And he's like, I'm going to put all that in there.
So, right. And he took it next generation, like the special effects. Mm-hmm. No one had ever seen that before.
Right.
Kind of the epic size of it, no one had ever seen before.
Yeah.
Like the cinematography was different than any movie before.
Right. It's not a 50, it's not, you know, how are there 10? It's not a 10-hour movie. It's 10 2-hour movies, right?
Right.
And so he's understanding the commercial landscape. He's understanding human nature. You know, you've got to think about these things. Like, so when I wrote Perennial, I originally sold my publisher a book about book marketing. And then, because that's one of the things my company does. And I have a pretty unparalleled track record there. But as I sat down to think about, I remember I was giving a talk in Puerto Rico, and I was just needing to start to get serious about writing the book. And as I left the talk, you know, I was talking to the people who liked it, and they said it was great, and they'd read my books and all this stuff. And then I thought, there's no way, if I write a book about book marketing, that I could ever reach any of the people in this room. Because even though I take lessons from books that apply to my business at large, they don't see themselves as needing lessons in book. There's like one book marketing conference or book conference of any weight. So I'm not going to be able to reach any of the people in this room if I do a book about book marketing. And, you know, I look at the creative landscape and there's lots of books about book marketing. So I decide to pivot and I change around this concept of what's perennial, what lasts, I don't want to write a book that I'm going to have to rewrite in 2 years when some of the tactics change. So these are really important things that you have to think about. And again, I think you have to think about them if you're opening a pop-up shop to sell t-shirts too. You know, like whatever you're doing, these things matter. If you're writing a screenplay, you're going to be a painter. You have to be thinking about you have to get all the pieces right. You don't just make what's for you, else has an audience of one.
Let's brainstorm for a second. So the pop-up store on t-shirts. Yeah. Okay, I want to create or a store in general on t-shirts. Sure. I want to create a perennial feeling type of store. Now, the genre of t-shirt stores exists.
Right.
T-shirts are creative. There are creative t-shirts out there that exist. What's maybe one way I can start thinking that would make it a little bit kind of 10x instead of 20% better?
Well, look, think about American Apparel, where I was the director of marketing. And look, the company had some difficulties that prevented it from being as perennial as it could have continued to be, but it was around for 20 years. And what did Dove do? He said, you know, most t-shirts are not made for ordinary people, right? They're made, they're the sizes, it's like this one size fits all mentality. The fabric sucks. It's made in a sweatshop, you know, all these things. And he said, I question all those assumptions. I think a t-shirt should feel good. I think it should fit well. I don't think it should exploit anyone. And I know that the people I know in my community agree with that. And so he makes this, you know, he makes the American Apparel's number one selling product was called the 2001. That was its t-shirt. And it's, I think, one of the best t-shirts ever made. And one of the things he thought about when he was making his t-shirts and hoodies, and he was like, I want to make things that you can buy in a vintage shop 10 years from now. Like, he loved how you could go into a vintage shop and it's only the clothes that survived that are in that vintage shop. He's like, I want to make those kind of products now. And he said, the other problem with the fashion industry is that the fashion industry thinks in seasons, right? What are we making this fall? Right now, their fall lines are already going into production and they're planning their winter and spring lines. And then next year, they'll start the whole process over again. And he said, why? Wouldn't it be better to make a t-shirt that's perfect and sell it every year? So he did. He created a perennial apparel company, one of the first ones ever, by making really great products and only a few of those products and letting them develop an audience. So instead of trying to sell one trendy t-shirt to everyone, he wanted to sell the same t-shirt to someone every year, or, you know, whenever they wore it out.
So it makes me think a little bit of when Facebook and Peter Thiel. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Peter Thiel earlier, and Peter Thiel was one of the first investors in Facebook.
Yeah.
And so I asked Peter Thiel when he was on the podcast, you know, there was 7 social networks before Facebook, and you're always going on like, don't compete, don't try to be the same thing as everyone else. What made Facebook different? And his answer was, Facebook was so, you know, there was GeoCities, there was Friendster, there was MySpace, there was Tribe.com, there was a whole bunch of things. He said Facebook was the first one with real identity. Like, you had to, initially, you had to have a .edu email address, you had to be a real student, then you had to work for a real company, and they checked this somehow.
Yeah.
I forget how they did it, but it was, so it was an interesting point that it was, and even to this day, you're not allowed to have a fake Facebook account.
Right, you can have a joke Twitter account, but you can't have a fake Facebook account. You have to be you.
I thought that was interesting. That was his way of not, even though he was in the genre of social networks, he also had no competition. There was no competition of social networks where identity was authenticated.
Yeah, and look, it's not that you have to go do something totally new all the time, but it's like, if you're going to write a Western, don't truck in all the Western cliches, because now you're going to have to go up against all the best Westerns that have ever been written. But if you did something new or unique or special, like, I think Cowboys and Aliens is a very underrated movie, as a Jon Favreau movie. And it's like, he was like, I want to make a Western in 2014 or whenever it was. Like, what can I do that's unique or interesting about this genre? I think it's a great movie, but...
So okay, let's brainstorm some more. So, leadership books.
Yeah.
There's 1,000 leadership books out there. 99.999% of them just totally suck. And then the authors go on and make speeches that are so boring. And it's a whole industry of leadership. Uh-huh. If you wanted to make a perennial, and there are some perennial books about leadership, like The 1 Minute Manager is a perennial book about leadership that always sells.
Right.
So if you wanted to now look at that industry and make a perennial book about leadership, how would you start thinking about it?
I might make, almost all the leadership books are like, here's how to do it. An interesting way might be like, here's like a book of leadership failures. Like, here's all the things that terrible leaders do. Mm-hmm. That would be you could write the same, like I did this with Ego. I wanted to write a book about humility. I realized it wasn't working. And so I wrote a book about the cost of ego, which is it's the same book with the same principles, but a different angle. So it's like, you might think you have this book on leadership of all the things that you want people to do. Just flip it and go, here's what bad leaders do. Or what if you wrote a book that helped people decide whether they are a leader or not? Because not everyone is, right? Like, so maybe this book is, you know, you should be the CEO, you should be the COO and not the CEO.
I like that. Number two.
Right.
That could be the title of the book.
That's amazing. Right. Right. Or you are not a leader. Because there's that book, you are a badass. It could just be you are not a leader.
Right.
But yours is better because number two is more counterintuitive, where you are not a leader is negative.
Number two, and then the subtitle, be the best you could be.
Yes. I love it. Yes. That's amazing. I might do a book on... I just read this book. It's an old book. I didn't like it that much, but it was an interesting concept where it's like Hannibal and me. I like books where people will go like the leadership lessons of Julius Caesar or the leadership lessons of Genghis Khan. Like take someone, I bet you could write a book right now that would do well that would be like leadership lessons from Richard Nixon. And it would do well right now because Nixon is in the news because of Trump, but it could be perennial because Nixon is always going to be controversial, right? So maybe there's leadership lessons from people that you wouldn't think you could learn from, that you think you should do the opposite of, right? Hitler came to power somehow, right? And he managed to be in power for a long time. There must be something he did that that a non-psychopath could learn from, right? So like what are negative things what are good things you could learn from bad people? That might be another lesson.
Yeah, now I'm picturing the Richard Nixon one because, you know, he, of course, opened up with China. You could almost have like a red book, like the Mao Tse-Tung book.
Yeah.
And it's like the red book of Richard Nixon.
Yeah. And part of the reason he did those things was he had to distract people from the stuff that he just messed up, you know? So that could be an interesting lesson. You know, you could do an all-female one. That might be an interesting take. So I'd be going, what is everyone else doing? And I want to do not that. That's probably the easiest place to start from. You know, I was thinking that a lot of people lack strategic clarity. Like they're trying to do everything all at once. They don't actually know what they want. To me, what a leader has is like clear understanding of what they're, and we talked about this, but what they're trying to do and not do. And I think a book on that topic would do really well also.
Hmm. Yeah, how to decide kind of which column things are in.
Right, like Essentialism is a wonderful book, but like what is essentialism for leaders? You know, how would you apply that to the leadership part of it?
Now, one thing you mentioned in the book, you have this phrase,
Oh, by the way, sorry. You know what's another great concept on someone who did this is like, sales books, everyone writes sales books and none of them sell. And Dan Pink wrote To Sell as Human. And so he took this thing that everyone thinks is scammy and gross and he turned it into a manifesto, like a love story almost. And of course, every sales organization had to have him come talk. Every salesperson loved the book because it's, you know, I worked on a book a couple years ago called The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. How many people work in the oil and gas industry? They don't think they're bad people. And I wouldn't say that they are, but they don't think they're bad people. And so he wrote a book that gives them a new way of thinking about what they do. And that's, I think that's really important.
So one thing you say, I mean, as part of when you start to veer into the marketing, so there's kind of like the creative nuances you have to master to develop a perennial. And then there's the marketing. And one thing you say, before you get into platform, you say participate, participate, participate.
Yeah.
And that's actually really hard at some point. Like you can't go to every conference, every meeting. You can't go on every podcast. You can't participate in everything or else you get no work done.
No, that's true. It is a balance. But I think some people don't see... They think that their work is just to make the painting and then they're done, or to write the book and then they're done. But I think it's like the writing the book. I told David Berkus this. I was saying, your job is not to publish books. You're a writer who occasionally publishes books, right? And so it's like, that's how I see it, is that I'm writing all the time and occasionally I have a book come out. So I don't do my work over here in isolation, and occasionally I come up for air and interact with people.
Well,
it's the other way around.
I find what's really important is to have an umbrella understanding of what your field is.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, I always use Louis C.K. as an example. So people say, okay, he's a stand-up comic. But he's a stand-up comic who used to be the head writer of various late-night shows like Conan and the Chris Rock Show. He's written or developed, you know, three or four different sitcoms. He's produced another four or five sitcoms. He's produced other people's comic tours and negotiated to get them on Netflix or wherever.
I think he's written for other comedians.
Yeah, he's done every aspect. He's done an umbrella. So people say, well, where should you focus? Should he have just done stand-up comedy? I think if he had just done that, he wouldn't be the comedian he is today. I think at some point you have to figure out what your umbrella is. So for instance, I write... But I podcast and I get a lot of material from the podcasting. I syndicate on many publications and write for many other publications. I give talks. I do other things to get material for the writing. Because again, you have to do also to get material.
Yeah,
you can't just sit in your house.
Right. No, I think it's true. You got it. Like, I realized that I could be on podcasts all day. So I've severely limited the amount that I do so I can spend more time writing. But it's also just like, where's the ROI on your participation? You know, it's like, you could spend all day on Twitter interacting with people, but is it selling books? Is it bringing in new fans? You got to be able to look at the numbers and know. You know?
Yeah. So like how many things, so even though you say participate, I think it's very strategic. Like how many things do you get asked to per day that you say no to?
Yeah. A large number, more now.
Because when I read
that
in the book, I felt a little guilty. Like, oh, I blow off most people.
No, I don't. I mean, look, your form of participation is mostly in what you make, right? Like you're participating by putting yourself out. I mean, I see you all the time. I'm like,
yeah, I definitely go everywhere.
Yeah,
I definitely am everywhere.
Like, is James just answering random questions on Quora today? Like you have the opposite of the participation problem. You can't stop yourself from participating.
Right. You know, now I'm trying to not say yes to as many. I mean, I wrote the book, The Power of No.
Yeah.
Not because I'm an expert in it, but because I need to learn it.
But see, and it's like, hey, I'm having this problem. Lots of people have this problem. By exploring it, maybe I'll solve the problem for myself and learn something and help other people. That book made total sense.
Yeah. And then, you know, the next thing is on platform. Mm-hmm. You know, and like you mentioned, every publisher, the first thing they ask an aspiring author now is, what's your platform?
Right.
In fact, that's the kind of cliche, annoying question they all ask now. And if you don't have a platform, they simply walk you to the door.
Unless you have an amazing, mind-blowing idea, right? Like, you know.
Which everybody thinks they do, but very few people do.
Sure, right. You know, you're the first person to write a biography of Elon Musk. Doesn't matter what your platform is. Your platform is the person you're writing about, right?
Right.
But there are ways to get around it, but yes, it's what I say is that it's the idea and the platform. They have to add up to a very high number, you know, and the smaller your platform, the better the idea has to be.
And I would say you talk a lot. I mean, the one kind of tactical thing you mentioned in this book, everything you say about perennial sellers is extremely important. And this is a topic that fascinates me. Like, you know, what makes Star Wars great? What makes the Beatles great?
Right.
What makes the Shawshank Redemption or The Firm or Facebook or whatever great? All of these questions you answer so well, and I've never seen them answered so well in one book. And then the only, and to your credit, the main tactical advice you give is the one thing that's not going away is email. You say build your email list. So Facebook may go away as a way to reach your fans, but email you can always have control over. That's your way to directly touch the people who appreciate what you do. And you give a great story of Kevin Hart.
Yeah.
I didn't even know Kevin Hart had an email list. Like, that struck me as unusual.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Hart was the sort of up-and-coming, young comic, you know, comedic actor. And then the show he was supposed to be in didn't work. The couple movies he was supposed to be in bombed. And he had to go back out on the road to make a living. But he went back out on the road with a very specific idea of building a huge platform, specifically an email list, so he could sell his tickets directly to fans, not need to rely on advertising. And he built, you know, a huge email list. He would even, it's not like he ignored social media, but he hosted like the BET Awards so he could get more Twitter followers. And so his idea was, I want to build a huge platform because that makes me in some ways independent. Like, you've asked me a couple times why I don't self-publish. And I don't self-publish because I don't think it's made sense for the books that I've done. But if tomorrow my publisher went out of business, I could self-publish. And the only thing it would substantively change is like that I would have to invest in my books a little bit more upfront. But like, I have my audience and I've worked to develop a relationship directly with them. And I think it's interesting. Yeah, you know, Facebook is what, like 10 or 15 years old, probably between there. You know, Twitter is 10 plus years old. These things are, they're around, but they could go away. We have no idea how long it's going to be. And but email is like almost 50 years old. It's not going anywhere. It could potentially, but right now it is the most perennial of all the mediums, and it's the one that you have the most direct connection with.
And I think developing strategies to build those email lists, and you give some strategies, you speak with Noah Kagan, who's been a regular guest on this podcast as well, and he's been a partner of mine in terms of me building my own email list. You give some good strategies, but I think the most important one is say unique things on a lot of different platforms and have just an email link at the bottom, like, hey, click here to get my next thoughts on this topic.
Yeah, I mean, you have a call to action that converts at a certain percentage. So the more people you reach on all these different platforms, the more emails you're going to capture, the more address. And I'm starting to think even now with Daily Stoic, where we started to sell some physical products, we have mailing addresses too. And I mean, I know you with your stuff, like sometimes you physically mail things to people. So it's like, that's the most perennial. Like, doesn't matter. Technologically, things are going to change, but unless the singularity happens, we're all going to live in a physical place for, you know, some period of time. So it's how can I reach you directly is what I want.
I think also it's a good way to focus group the idea.
Sure.
So people aren't going to, you know, you'll get a sense of the percentage that people read an article who then sign up for your email list. So you start to know for each article you write on each platform, which platforms work for you, which topics work for you, you know, to build that readership base. I think there's a lot of testing can happen. Like Choose Yourself, I would say, was tested for a good 3 or 4 years. Every chapter was sort of individually tested before it kind of came together as a book.
Yeah.
And I think stuff like that's really important.
Well, it's interesting when I look at my email address or my email list, you know, it started with 100 people. It was small enough that I could just copy and paste them into the BCC field. Now it's like 80,000 or something. When I look at it, you know, when my first book came out, it was like 3,000, you know, but it has huge spikes each time I put out books because those books, I put a call to action. I mean, the back of this book has a call to action in my email list. Each one of my books has, my email list sold the first several thousand copies of the book. And then as the book took off and, you know, started to get publicity and press and word of mouth, now the books are selling the email list, which then allows me to tell them about my other books.
Yeah, no, I think it's very powerful. So I want to ask you this. So I mentioned to you earlier, we were coming up here. This is the first year I've written 18 books. This is the first year since 2003 that I'm not currently in the middle of writing at least one book. And I'm writing articles almost every day still, but I just don't feel any need to write a book. I've been kind of throwing it into podcasting and some other things. But take this podcast. And you've worked with me since the beginning of this podcast. I took your advice quite a bit. And I want to take this podcast to the next level. There's a lot of like just kind of basic interview podcasts. And I'm kind of sick of all of them. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. But again, it's that phenomenon where I can't just be a 30% better interviewer than everyone else because the average listener doesn't know how to recognize 30% versus zero. I want to be 10 times better.
Right.
So the way I'm thinking is, expand the number of podcasts I do because I think I offer a quality service, so might as well offer more of it. Second, I'm thinking of doing like mini series.
Yep.
So within the context of the podcast. So I'll do something with AJ Jacobs, who we both know, where we each challenge each other to experiments every week and do something fun there. Or I'm trying an experiment where I'm trying to get better at a skill I'm no good at, which is stand-up comedy, and then have do a bunch of episodes where comedians analyze my approach. So I'm just trying to think of things that are slightly off format.
No, I love that. It's like looking at... Tim does this well where sometimes he'll just have like an audiobook excerpt. Like he'll just have... It's like he's seeing it as a tube to put any kind of audio content down, not constraining himself by a one-on-one interview.
So he doesn't get worried that just doing an audiobook excerpt might be such a bad idea that he'll lose audience for his interview shows?
I don't think so. I mean, obviously you have to know what your audience likes and you have to make things you think they like, but it also, you know, there's a risk in doing anything new. But I would wonder if there's like almost like stories that you could do. Like you could have an episode about like if you took your most viral article and you turn it into an expanded 22-minute episode, audio episode, how would it do? I was interviewed on that podcast Startup last year. They did like a 10-episode arc about a single thing. I wonder if you, like, what if you decided to like take the first time you went bankrupt and you talked about it, but then you also went and you interviewed people
that'd be a fun idea.
Who were like part of it. And so it was not just your perspective. Like, what would you learn from it? What would other people learn? And it's not as if you don't have evidence that the audience is interested in that topic. What if you did a series on like why you shouldn't buy a house? And you talked about the buying of your first house, but you also interviewed some experts. You had Ramit on. You know, you could do it sort of like a mix between. It's almost like gonzo journalism kind of. It's like you experiencing the thing, but also talking to other people. I bet that would be popular.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I'm thinking of ways to change the format a little bit that hasn't been done before.
Sure,
but so. Perennial Seller by Ryan Holiday. This, by the way, is I've loved all your books, obviously. This is, it's true. I saw you wrote it in your email list, but this really is my favorite book
by you
by far, because also it's a topic that's dear to my heart. And I'm always curious about these things. Like you probably heard my discussion with Cass Sunstein, or at least, you know, he covers some of this in his book, but just about Star Wars. Before this podcast, I accompanied you to go on Good Day New York.
Yeah.
And we took photos of you on the show and even you doing makeup. The idea that process is art.
Mm-hmm.
So the process of you doing a book is also important. Like and you talk about this in Perennial Seller, like some of your anecdotes with Lance Armstrong and Iron Maiden and so on. Process definitely plays a role in this book and in your other books.
Yeah, I don't think you want to make something that's self-indulgent that's all about you, but you want to bring what only you can bring to the table. And like when I market this book, I'm going to I've recorded everything I made while making this book, and I'm going to show how it was made from the original note card, from the book proposal to the note card that inspired the book to the when I read the audiobook 2 weeks ago and I was still marking up pages. I kept all of it, and I'm going to scan it and show how it works.
So once again, thanks for coming on the podcast. I really want to figure out how many times you've been on. So you came on when your first book. We've come on with each book. So
each book, and then there was one that was not related to the books.
Yeah, so...
So that would be a lot.
I think this is your sixth time on the podcast, actually. So, and then I've written about conversations we've had, and you've written about them too, about conversations we've had after the podcast. So when are you next coming on? What's the next thing?
I'm doing a journal for the Daily Stoic that you write in the morning and at night, so that'll come out. And then my next book is, we talked about it a lot, but my next book is about the war between Peter Thiel and Gawker. So I am chugging away on that.
That's going to be out in a while.
Hopefully sooner, because I think it's newsworthy. So I'm killing myself to get it done.
But. And just to see that you take your own advice, what are you doing to market this book over the next couple of weeks?
Well, you know what? I'm not thinking about hitting any bestseller lists. I'm not thinking about pre-orders, really. I'm thinking about how do I get it in the hands of the people who will get it into the hands of the... So I'm doing a talk at Penguin Random House today to all the people who work at my publisher to talk to them about... How they, like, I want them, when they sign a new author, to give them this book. You know, so I want to implant myself in the creative space first and foremost, especially with authors. So I'm going to show a lot of the process. I'm going to use my list. I'm going to do some publicity. We're going to create an indestructible version of the book as a stunt.
Do you mean? Like
we're going to print it on fireproof paper and then we're going to try to light it on fire and stuff like that. Yeah.
So yeah, stunt marketing.
Do it all, man.
Yeah.
I will use the book as a playbook for the marketing for the book for sure.
Excellent.
Yes.
All right. Well, Ryan, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Before you go, I wanted to just say thank you to everyone who has rated and reviewed this podcast on iTunes. For instance, Tim at AgGrad, AGGRAD, said, "This is my favorite podcast by far. Seriously, not hyperbole. James is a genius. He researches guests extensively and always seems to deliver the perfect question at the perfect time. He has a very high standard for guests. Every episode makes me think. Highly recommend." Tim, that was a really great review. Thank you. I'm going to try, hopefully, to keep the same standard of questions and we'll see. But I really enjoy reading these. So Tim, it means a lot to me and I'm grateful for your support.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.